Hi, and welcome back to another episode of She Mentors. My name is Ali, and I'm the founder of She Mentors. We are a passionate community of women in business who all give back and drive change. So recently in our private Facebook group, I asked our members what they needed help with, and they all voted for lots of different topics. And one of the top ones was how to ask for a pay rise, how to have that difficult conversation with your boss or your manager and articulate your self-worth. So I went on the hunt and I found a fantastic speaker on this topic. Her name is Kate Borah. She is the founder of Young Professional Women Australia. She's also a keynote speaker and author of a really great book called Core Confidence. And she's developed sort of 7 steps to asking for a pay rise. So in today's episode, she's going to share her tips and advice and hopefully inspire lots of you to take the leap and ask for what you are really worth. Kate, thank you so much for being on the She Mentors podcast with us. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So this is my first podcast back after having baby Eva, who's 9 weeks old. So I'm just going to put a disclaimer that if anyone hears some crying in the background, she's being looked after by her dad, but there might be a few little squeaks. So I'm just going to put that out there. Now, Kate, do you want to give people a little overview of you and your business and your book as well for anyone that doesn't know you?
Yeah, for sure. So Kate Borah, founder and CEO of Young Professional Women Australia. At the end of my second decade of my career, in what I now refer to as, the second stage of my career life cycle. So started my professional career as an accountant, studied with KPMG and became a chartered accountant, and did that for, I guess, the first 10 years, both in public practice and then also working in commerce. And I guess was coming up against the big 3-0 and wasn't feeling super fulfilled. I'd have kind of arrived at the salary destination and job title that I'd probably been working to for sort of 7 years or so, the goal you set just out of uni, and kind of got to a point where I was like, gosh, is this it? Worked hard, achieved some great stuff, but probably wasn't feeling super fulfilled. So a couple of years of personal development really got me to a point where I decided to take a bit of a chance and step out and run my own consulting firm. And that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years. And that has been a mix of a number of different things. I think anyone who has left their corporate career to start their own business or start their own side hustle, it's a big journey, one that you and I have talked about certainly before now. But I think over that 10 years really worked, was really passionate about employee engagement and human capital. So I've done a lot of leadership development work, and then in that process really kind of saw an important conversation to start having with women, typically in that 20 to 40 category, so early to mid-career, around helping them get clear about what they want, really taking control and ownership of that career pathway, and I guess challenging their organisations and their leaders to do things a little bit differently. We've kind of got permission to have it all. and it's probably harder now than ever with technology, customer expectations, organisation expectations to be able to achieve that. And so that kind of led me to establish Young Professional Women Australia. We're a community for women focused, particularly women working in corporate, really centred around building confidence, career plans, community and connection.
Yeah, I love it. And I really resonate with that sort of turning 30 and thinking, what am I doing? How can I progress? How can I get flexible working? Like, that age seems to be the age that a lot of people think, okay, I need to start planning, doesn't it?
We call it the thrisis. and I think it comes, depending on what's going on in life, it can come anywhere between 27 and, 37. I think it's really about, what's distracting you in that period. Some people go off and travel and so they're busy traveling for 3 years, come back and settle into, life and find that maybe and these are the conversations I'm having with women all the time. You know, I might be mid-30s, I'm a lawyer, I spent 15 years kind of heading in this direction, thinking this is what I want, but I'm miserable. And what is it that I do now? You know, do I kind of start again, or how do I find a work life and a career and broader life that really is going to fulfill me in a way that's sustainable. And I think that's the kicker. Those first few years of career, you know, in some level, work hard, know your stuff. And hopefully, you know, if you've got a good leader, then often they're relatively easier to navigate. The more senior we get into our career, the more that we come up against some really harder things that aren't so much about who you are and what your skill, capability, experience is. It's more about who you know and how you're treated.
That's a big one, isn't it? Who you know. I think that's why it's so important to have like a network of really solid people around you to help. Because that's a lot of my community. So similar kind of age demographic, you know, professionals and side hustlers and business owners who have potentially come from corporate backgrounds and thought, do you know what, I want my own business or career path, and everybody struggles with that. And a lot of the people in my community actually want more meaningful work. So that, like you said, they go through their corporate careers and then suddenly they're like, hang on a minute, I'm not making an impact on the world, or I don't feel like a connection to my employer. So I really resonate with that. I think a lot of our community does. So
you want to do something that matters, you know, particularly if you're giving a lot of time, energy and focus to be able to make a difference. And we see that in engagement data across organisations, you know, purpose, meaning, all really high engagement drivers for individuals in context of, career planning and workplace motivation.
And the reason obviously we're talking today is to talk about one of the biggest hurdles that I think a lot of women face is negotiating pay rises, talking about money. I mean, this is such a big one. And one of the reasons I got in touch with you is because a lot of the members were saying, you know, how do we go about asking for a pay rise? How do we have those difficult conversations? How do we present ourselves to our managers and bosses? And I really, like, you've sent me a fantastic document, a resource with 7 steps to asking for a pay rise and what to do. You're waving it up now. I love that. So we can actually share that at the end of this podcast for people to download. It's really, really good. So I thought we would sort of, first of all, understand from you, like, what are the latest kind of stats around women asking for pay rises, and why are you so passionate about this topic?
Yeah, look, I think we've spent a lot of time in the last 12 months or so in this space. I had a lot of conversations with clients, and this year's been really interesting in the conversations we've been having. And clients we work with, get anywhere between, I mean, we've had a client this year double her salary. So she was already on 6 figures and amazing. Took a promotion, a new role. But we also work with clients who in existing organisations are negotiating salary increases of $20,000 and $30,000. Probably this year more than ever we've been doing, you know, $20,000 is not unusual. And it's really highlighted to me how underpaid women are, and how much we avoid the conversation. Just tonight I was talking with a potential client. We're talking about money and remuneration. She works in a smaller organisation and a small business. And so the language she used was, you know, any money I'm getting is coming out of their pockets. And that's a really awkward conversation to have. And this individual is, you know, mid-30s, highly qualified. It's interesting because if it feels uncomfortable on her side and they make it awkward and uncomfortable, being the organisation and the employer, that makes it even harder for the individual to front up and have that conversation. But if we're not having that conversation this year and we're taking what we're given and we do the same behaviour next year and the same behaviour the year after, we're looking at 3 years of salary increases that we haven't gone in and owned and negotiated. And that's how this big gap starts to emerge. And I think it's not just about salary. And, you know, it's interesting that I've spent so much time this year talking about money because that's not what I'm motivated on. It's certainly never been a priority for me. It's important, but it's kind of, you know, for me, purpose and meaning, growth, development were always stronger drivers of engagement. But there just seems to be this huge hole. Now, we're talking about it a lot on the gender pay gap, right? So, you know, it's an issue, but part of the issue is that women aren't asking. And I see that every day with clients I work with. We see it in research that we've done Last year, we did a Women at Work study on 1,000 Australian women from the YPWA community. And, you know, the results of that research, and people can grab a copy from our website if they'd like, and we can share that, but was that, 39% of women felt that they were fairly remunerated for the contribution. So, you know, typically we see in engagement data and results, no one ever, male or female, thinks they're fairly paid. So that number is quite consistent with Australians, but I'd say more broadly across the globe. But 52% felt that they were underpaid by at least 10% or more. Mm. Now, again, consistent. What's concerning is of that 52%, less than half had actually had a conversation with their leader. Mm. So not only do I feel underpaid, what concerns me the most is half of those people are not having conversations about it and not opening up, having the dialogue to say, hey, listen, you know, this is where I'm at, this is what I'd like, and having a conversation and setting an expectation, if not for this year, for years to follow.
Did they say in that survey why they hadn't had the conversation?
We didn't ask the question necessarily, but I hear it all the time, and that is, it feels uncomfortable to open it up. You know, I think there's some gender biases at play that we take what we're given. Certainly in my career, I was told you never negotiate salary, which was from a mentor I really respected. And so to front back up to him when I was promoted and to negotiate salary, and a big salary increase, it was $40,000, was one of the hardest things I've done professionally. But, it's this piece of, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable, it's about me articulating my value, which we know already is difficult for men and women, but particularly for women. Mm-hmm. We don't have good platforms that allow us to measure our value. So, you know, how do I know what I'm worth unless I go to what we call market test and, mm-hmm. you know, go out and interview and see what the market's willing to pay? Lack of transparency around what people next to me are being paid also makes it difficult. What we see in the public sector is a much stronger transparency of remuneration. They tend to operate in bandings. So roles are graded with a grade 7-8, and that's a band, that's a $10,000 band. So what we see with transparency of remuneration is a much smaller gender pay gap across the public sector. And so all of these things culminate into, you know, a whole lot of barriers that make it uncomfortable, awkward, and difficult for us to front up and have a conversation that generally we don't even want to have in the first place. And I see it every day. You know, it's kind of me sitting there going, hey, this is what you're underpaid, and probably having someone external who can give some solid feedback that encourages people to open up a dialogue is part of the push people need in order to be able to start. What I always say is, you know, start the journey towards a good salary conversation and negotiation.
Mm. Going back to what you're saying about payment bands, do you think that's actually a good way for companies to kind of structure their pay?
Yeah, look, I'm all for transparency. So, you know, there's some really progressive organisations in the States that literally just publish everyone's salary and pay, you know, pay reviews are done by consensus. And so, you know, all staff see what everyone's paid and what increases. It's an interesting one. Mm. You know, if we compare to another extreme, whereas some organisations in their employment contracts say, people are forbidden from sharing their remuneration details with colleagues, which, you know, that in and of itself is interesting, because what would happen if people did, and what secrets are they trying to hide? So, you know, I always say to people, open up a dialogue. Like, there's only one reason you shouldn't be sharing it, because there's something to hide. And when we start to shine a light on all of these sorts of things, and we've seen that with gender pay gap calculations, organisations who would suggest that they don't have issues, and then when they actually do the basic mathematics calculation, are quite surprised at what they see. Mm. So, you know, I think all of these things together make it difficult.
Yeah, I agree. And I've heard a lot about that. I interviewed Gemma Lloyd from Diversity Careers. Do you know her?
I've heard of her.
And she talks a lot about that, about having transparent payment bands, and she's a massive fan of that too. And I'm kind of I feel like that too now. Now I've had the conversations around that. I do feel like it would be so much easier and fairer to have that.
So the challenge we've got is there's a lot of shame wrapped up around remuneration. I always in a room say to people, how many people know what their best friend earns? And literally less than 15% of hands, maybe 20 go up. So between 10 and 20. And it's interesting because it's, if we think about the sorts of things we talk about with our best friend, this is kind of a big thing. And so what stops us having a conversation about money? A number of things, but one that's really present is this piece of, it's a reflection of what I'm worth. And if I haven't spoken up and negotiated, then what does it say about me? So I'm not so sure it's actually as much around money as it is around what does it say about me in terms of what I'm worth and how much I've been willing to back myself. And I think that's probably more of the uncomfortable conversation. Mm. I say all the time to clients, if I was to tell you your colleague who's sitting next to you who does a similar job was earning 20 grand or more than you, what impact would that have? What would you do differently? And most people go, well, I'd go in and have a conversation. The problem is if we don't know that, we're not leveraged enough or armed with information to be able to go and have that conversation.
Mm. And often I find that we're not aware of how much money is on the table in our careers. So like when I first started my career, I had no idea of the amount of money they would pay for a digital marketing manager or a head of digital until I kind of climbed the ladder. And then other people started saying, hey, you could be getting 120 grand or you could be getting 140 grand for that kind of money. That never occurred to me when I was younger. Therefore, I would never ask for more than, the base salary that I thought, because you just don't know that kind of thing, do you, when you're first starting out?
Yeah. And, I almost kind of say, and for me, negotiation's important. Don't just take what you're given, because that's often the lowest offer on the table. And they can always say no. Mm. I think when you're negotiating salary in a new role, though, it can feel really uncomfortable and, we can feel like we're risking the opportunity and or risking the job offer. So it feels like it's a little bit risky to go in and have that conversation and a little bit ungrateful. I think the challenge I've always had, I don't like negotiating with recruiters because I never really know what I'm dealing with. You don't know, and I've had some really uncomfortable conversations that has left me, interestingly, as the person who's ended up taking the job, really unhappy and a little bit, bit of bad taste in my mouth with the organisation I was joining because of the nature of the remuneration conversation that I'd had with the recruiter, and quite possibly the actual client and the organisation I was joining had no idea about that conversation I was having. So, like I said, it's shrouded in shame and secrecy, and I don't think that's helpful for anyone.
I agree. So with finding out your worth and your market research before you were going into a situation like this, what kind of things would you recommend for people to do before they get into that conversation with their manager? Is there resources you can recommend, or is it a case of asking people?
Yeah, look, there's no perfect answer here, and I think that's part of the challenge that we definitely have. I think you can go and you can, there's employment salary data out there that a lot of the recruitment organisations do. I think my view on those, though, it's not a function. It's what employers are willing to pay. It's not actually what people are being paid. So it's not... it doesn't include volume. And so it's not a reflection of, okay, if we look at Australians in Sydney, all in marketing, there's 20,000 marketing directors or 20,000 marketing managers and the average salary is X. It's a function of, it's 2019 Q4 and an employer is willing to pay, a marketing manager X amount. So that information is useful, as long as you're really clear about what actually it represents, which is what organisations are willing to pay at a point in time. Usually they go and they kind of articulate the sort of size of an organisation, so you get a good sense. Being able to then, use that information to have conversations with recruiters or people within your network doing similar roles. I think the point you made around being able to reach out and know, you know, have contacts in your network beyond your organization in your field doing similar roles who can talk to you about, you know, what they get paid, what other people that they know of in their network get paid, so that you've got a sense of, you know, who gets paid, what industries pay certain levels. You know, there's certain industries that pay significantly more than other industries. Mm. And so that you get a good feel for that, and actually, you know, talking to recruiters and getting a sense of what your value is in the market. Again, I think you've always got to take that feedback with a grain of salt, because they're leveraged in terms of wanting to place you somewhere. So I think that's an important piece. Market testing, if you're at a point where you'd actually consider moving, going out and applying for roles and interviewing for roles, I guess the tip I always give clients here, for every role that you apply for that you think you can do, apply for one that you don't think you can do. Two things happen when you do that. The first is you expect rejection, and that's a good thing. You know, I think we spend way too much time analysing whether a role is a good fit for us, whether we would be accepted or considered for a role, when really it's the first step of a very long process. So, you know, applying for a role is really just an invitation or request to open up a dialogue to find out more about that role and to see if they think you'd be a good fit. So I think that's another way that you can get more information. The second thing that happens when you apply for roles you don't think you can do, surprise, surprise, you start getting interviews. And so that's a really good, we call it market testing, but that's a really good way. It takes effort and energy, but it's a really good way to understand what you're valued in the market, but also to do some really good due diligence on career paths and planning. And of course, you've got Glassdoor as well, which again has some good valuable information, but it's always a function of the input. So I think it's a matter of looking at a number of different sources and getting some good feedback and integrating that into a view.
Okay, perfect. So if you're at your company and you're thinking about asking for a pay rise, when would you say is a good time to do it? I know we talked initially about negotiating before you even start the role, but let's say we've been in the role for a year or 18 months and we're starting to think about, you know, a pay rise. What would you recommend people think about during that time, and what kind of time frames is the average or normal, or what you'd recommend?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is the worst time is when a letter is being pushed across the desk, which has got the decision documented. Yet for most of us, that's the time we're actually initiating a conversation, which is, oh, here's my letter and I'm not happy with it. The best time is really around when budgets are being put together. And in practice, that tends to be about 3 to 6 months before the end of the financial year, whatever that looks like, whether it's 30 June or December or any other period. But actually, when organisations and line managers are actually starting to lock in what my headcount budget's going to be for the next 12 months, starting to open up a dialogue, probably minimum 3 months, sometimes, you know, 4 to 6 is useful, because, you know, we've just closed in the last week a negotiation that we've been having with one of my clients. Again, a big number. So I kind of hold, when we're negotiating big salary increases for existing employees as part of restructures and promotions, it does take a little bit of time, and it probably, you know, to be fair, it should take a bit of time when you're talking about that sort of salary. But it does take, this one in particular has taken 6 months. So I think it's important to open up a dialogue early, three, four, maybe 6 months, but budget, you know, find out when budgets are being discussed, because that's when money's being locked in for the next year. It might not be allocated across headcount, but that's when divisions are going, okay, well, this is the amount of money that I'm going to have to play with when it comes time to allocating increases across my team. And it's starting to, you know, seed the conversation, get an understanding of, you know, what you can expect, get an understanding. I mean, the conversation I always say to people is, you know, get really clear about what you want to earn, and then figure out what is it you need to be doing in the organisation to earn that salary. Like, what role do you need to be doing? I'm not an advocate of pay rises every year. I think we're beyond that. The whole kind of, I think it's actually a waste of money, because organisations give everyone 2%, everyone's pissed off, yet the increases in, you know, the organisations increase their cost base. So I don't think that's helpful. I think actually looking at you know, what's market REM, four key roles, who do we want to secure? That's a much better way for organizations to actually approach remuneration increases. But as individuals, it's getting really clear, hey, this is what I want to be earning. What role or what contribution do I need to be making to the organization in order to get there? That's important because sometimes you might be in an organization that actually will never pay the sort of salary or will, more importantly, not actually need that level of a resource. So if we're talking about, you know, a digital marketing director, you know, there's businesses that, you know, well, that level is a $100,000 salary, and there's businesses where that level is a $200,000 salary. So it's useful to know what business you're in because you'll get a clear sense of what the upper ceiling is. And if you've got aspirations for, you know, that higher salary and, you know, the business would have to triple in order for that level of, you know, that level of salary and that level of role to be in existence, then you're in the wrong place. You're not going to achieve your goals. And I think that's the important conversation to have. And when it comes down to actually what's, you know, how do you lead into that? You know, we talk about the value-based conversation, which is what's the contribution you've made that warrants additional salary. It's not that I've turned up for another year. It's what contribution have I made to the success of the organization in the past 12 months. What am I going to make, contribution am I making to the success of the organization in the next 12 months? And what other contribution am I making that actually is above and beyond my pay grade or my role title? And that's a big one because really what we're saying is, you know, our salary is recognition for the role description that we have. Very rarely does that accurately reflect what we show up and do in an organization.
So that would obviously come in sort of preparation for that conversation. So is that kind of like, these are the things I've been doing really well, these are my results, these are the stats or the revenue I've brought to the company? And would you recommend kind of what, putting a document together, a sort of proposal? How would you recommend people prepare for it?
Yeah, we call a business case, but really fancy name for a one pager. And it's number four in the seven things to do before you ask for a pay rise, which is all around articulating your value stack. And here, you know, this is in stark contrast to people just showing up and saying, I think I should be paid more, full stop, end of conversation. You know, that's to be honest, that's lame from my perspective. Showing up and saying, hey, you know, I just want to talk to you about the value I've brought to the organization. REM season's coming up. You know, last year I kind of voiced the fact that maybe I wasn't happy with where I'm at. This is what I'm looking for and here's why. And to put it on a one-pager is important because sometimes the person you need to influence isn't always the person you're having the conversation with. So to arm your leader with some really good information so that they can then go in and advocate on your behalf is powerful. And then we look at it from three levels. The first is contribution in your current role. So here's the value, and you said it beautifully, the specific value. Get specifics. What problems do you solve? What value do you create? And people are not really good at articulating this. So I think, you know, the advice I'm always giving is, you know, brainstorm, piece of paper, come back to it a couple of days later, you know, work with someone to get some feedback, but really articulate specifically the problem you solve and the value you create for an organization from three perspectives. The first, based on your current role, this is the role description I was talking about, in theory what you're paid to deliver. The second lens we're looking for is above and beyond. So these are the things that's maybe not in your job description, but you're doing anyway. And these can be extra tasks that you've kind of acquired through expanding and crafting your role. It could be, you know, projects that you're putting your hand up to volunteer on as well. So that's the second lens, above and beyond current role. And then the third lens is the future. Here's when I think about what our priorities are for the next 12 months or 18 months of the organization, here's the contribution I'm making to the future success of the organization. What you're then doing is really asking for an increase based on three particular values. The first is, in theory, what you're paid to do. The second is extra stuff I've brought. And then the third is what's ahead. And so all of a sudden, when we think about the negotiation, you're in a stronger position because you're not just negotiating the historic 12 months.
I love that. I love the above and beyond and future planning, because that's when you kind of see managers' eyes light up and think, okay, so they're really like passionate and enthusiastic about this business. They're already thinking about the future. And I think that's really valuable to bring to the table. And the other thing that I always would say to my team is that with those extra things that you're doing is to make a note of those throughout the year, because you forget how many other things that you actually start doing. So I think it's really good to kind of have like a document online where you just note down some achievements, things you've done, of, you know, had great feedback. And then when you come to sort of start reviewing what you've achieved in the year, you can reference that document.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even just a folder in the inbox, which is feedback, where you just file, you know, emails that you've got from someone saying, hey, great job, or just file those sorts of things. Because you're totally right. You know, when people come to do their CV and they say, I say, well, you know, we've got no achievements here. What value did you bring to the organization? What problems do you solve? They look at me blankly. Or we've all sat down to do our performance review and kind of gone, I don't know, I just feel like I've been really busy, but I don't know what I've been doing. So I think there's some really good strategies. And also sitting down quarterly and, you know, being able to add to that document. But I think, you know, the X factor is articulating all of those things in a way that is meaningful to the organization, that really articulates the consequences that you have contributed or the outcome you've brought to the organization. So rather than, you know, talking about, and this goes for CVs as well as a business case for REM increase, you know, rather than saying, you know, implemented, you know, an ERP system across six sites, actually talk about the value that you've created for the organization that's increased, you know, data accuracy by however much percent. And because of that, allowed the organization to submit funding requests in a shorter time period, which has allowed an increase in funding across a period of time of, you know, X percent. Look at the actual tangible specific value that you've brought to the organization. Often it's the reason they asked you to implement the system in the first place. What was the original problem? Oh, it's just it's the opposite of that.
And it's reminding them as well of, like, you know, what, because the managers and, you know, CEOs of companies, they can't remember what you're doing all year. They forget, don't they? So I think it's good for them to you to remind them and say, hey, I did this project, it had this result, you know, this is fantastic for your business, because I think that's really good.
Yeah, and two key pieces. The first is, you know, exactly right. Everyone isn't always thinking about you and what you've done. So to be able to remind them and make it easy for them to say yes to you. You know, no leader turns up and wants to have the conversation and decline and increase. You know, most leaders in organizations value their people and want to get the best REM outcome. So make it easy for them to be able to advocate on your behalf. I think that's really important.
Mm. So how much should you ask for? And I know this is a really difficult question to answer, but let's say you were earning $70,000 and you've been at a company for 18 months. What kind of pay rise can you expect? I know it's very dependent on different companies and what they've got, but what's kind of cheeky? Should you ask for more than you think you should get? How do you advise people to go about that really, really difficult question?
So I don't think time period, how long you've worked there, is relevant. I mean, if you've been in an organization for 18 months and haven't had a REM conversation, you definitely need to be having one. You know, my view from a negotiation point of view is really, depending on what the conversation was on the way in, you know, you want to get in and prove yourself and deliver some value over the first 12 months. So usually in most organizations, that's the first time that the conversation will come up. But, you know, reach out to your leader and your HR contact and find out what's protocol. Most businesses have protocol around this. It's either a particular time every calendar year, or it's on an anniversary of being in an organization. In terms of how much to ask for, you know, to my point earlier, it's not really a function of time. Just because you've been in a role for 3 or 4 years doesn't mean you should be paid more. So I always come back to contribution, which is what's been your contribution to the success of the organization over the period you've been there. And, you know, how do you articulate the value? I think, you know, being able to look at market rates and get a good sense of what you could be paid elsewhere is useful. It's a useful piece of data to put on the table. You need to be very careful, though, that that's not seen as manipulation or blackmail, because people can read into that, you know, underneath that, which is, if you don't get what you want, you're leaving. So you need to be really careful and clear about that. I'm certainly, you know, I actually encourage people to be really overt around that, saying, look, I've got some data. You know, my purpose for doing that is not that I'm leaving, but I wanted to be able to get a good objective sense of where I'm at and what I can expect. I think you've got to be really clear in the conversation what you're asking for. Are you asking for money? Are you asking for title? And not to ask for too much. Asking for promotion or title as well as money can sometimes be difficult. One would suggest that they come hand in hand, but not always. Sometimes I had a client who was really clear that she didn't really have many career opportunities in the organisation she was at, but she really wanted a more senior title because she knew that in 6 months' time that would help her get a more senior role in a competitor. So for her, it was all about negotiating title because that was going to be a pathway to career progression once she left that organisation. In some organisations, titles are really tightly held. And, you know, I've seen this plenty of times where, you know, people will die in a ditch over the title. Like, no, you know, it is hen's teeth to be able to get that. And it's because of hierarchy and a whole bunch of stuff that goes on. But actually, the money's not such an issue. So I think get really clear about what you're asking for. Sometimes it's not even about the money. And I think sometimes it's actually about recognition and reward. Now, the fact that I show up and I'm delivering above and beyond and you don't even seem to recognize it or appreciate it. So I think that's really important. When I negotiated that big salary increase, it was nothing to do with the money. You know, I was already at a really good salary. I was, you know, late 20s, so I didn't really need the money. But actually it was about fairness. It was about fairness of the position I was being promoted into and the peers I was supposed to work with and the responsibility I was carrying in that business. And it was about fairness with regards to sitting at the table of what was expected of me. And that's why I went in quite hard and negotiated. And, you know, it was really difficult because I was so upset and disappointed when I got what I wanted. Interestingly, the end of that conversation after two rounds of very hard, difficult kind of standoffs, in the end he just said to me, well, what is it that you want, Kate? Now, I actually didn't know. And that's why I say get really clear about what your number is. You know, should you add 10 grand so you've got room to negotiate? I really take a case-by-case approach to that. I think with some egos and some businesses, you need to be able to let them feel like they've won. So coming back and offering you 5 or 10 grand less than what you've asked for might be an important part of the negotiation strategy. My preference is always to go in, if you've got a really good relationship with your leader, with exactly what you want, and be really clear that this is what I expect and what I want, and anything less than that would be disappointing. And, you know, particularly the one that we've just finished recently that was part of a restructure and a promotion and has taken a long time, she was just really clear on the number she wanted. And they came back with, you know, kind of a $25,000 increase. And she said, I asked for 10 more than that. That's what I want. And they said, oh, well, we might be able to get you 5. And she said, I've asked for 10. Uncomfortable to hold that tension. The safest thing is to go, thank you very much for the 25,000, because you kind of come across as an ungrateful bitch, right? And, you know, if we think about what goes on for us as individuals, you know, I'm having to really back myself. You've just come back and offered me 25. Now, the beauty of this one, and this is a client I've worked with for 9 months, when I first started talking with her, you know, she was already $20,000 less of what she should have been on then, and then she got promoted. So we had a really strong position. One of the beautiful things that came, though, was she was approached by a competitor to apply for a role, which was a significant increase. So that kind of market data really leveraged her to really go in and ask for what she want. And we got it, but, you know, again, having to hold that tension that say, no, I'm not going to say yes to 25. I asked for 35 and I want it.
Mm. Good for her. Well done. That's very good. And also, I totally agree that often if you have a counter offer, it does give you that confidence to go and stick to what you actually want, because that's actually the only way that I've ever had a pay rise in my whole time that I've been working, is when I've gone, when I've had a counter offer on the table and I've had the courage to be like, actually, I'm not going to just settle for that. I want this. And if you aren't able to give me that, that's okay, because I've got this other offer. It's the only way I've ever managed to negotiate, which is sad, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because it's you've got external proof that you're worth that. So you're not relying on your own sense of value, and on some level you've got nothing to lose. And it's really interesting to watch human behavior when you've got nothing to lose. We had one client walk in to an interview for a role that she really wasn't interested in. And because of that, she was just, you know, just went in and nailed it. You know, she said, it's probably the best interview I've ever done. She walked out, they offered her the role. She went, no, I don't want it. It's not right for me. And they came back and went, oh, actually, and this is already a salary increase. They came back and said, oh, actually, well, we'd like to offer you this role, which was $20,000 more than the role she was interviewing for. So I think it's interesting what happens when you've got nothing to lose.
So much. I love that as well. What happens though on the flip side when things don't go as planned and actually you just get turned away, or they're like, no more money on the table?
Yeah, I think get really clear. So if it's a no, you know, my reframe on that is not yet or not now. So going back and having a conversation that says, okay, well, what else or how else could this look? So maybe not headcount, so maybe not salary FTE, but, you know, as an accountant, I know there's other places money can come from. So is that potentially negotiating a four-day work week? And maintaining salary, but actually going decreasing your hours. That's one way to approach it. Is it around extended leave? So going, well, actually, you know what? I really want to go traveling this year. So I want an additional 4 weeks annual leave, and I'm heading overseas for 8 weeks. You know, can I negotiate that? Or, you know, learning opportunities, learning and development opportunities. Or, you know, that's where I come back to, what is it that you really want? Because maybe, you know, shadowing a senior executive or working 2 days in another division where you can gain skill, capability and experience that's valuable to you is a way to get meaning and recognition and appreciation that isn't just a tangible, you know, wage or salary line that's taxed anyway. So getting creative around what other forms it could come in. The second thing is to say, okay, well, I'd like to open up a discussion around this in 6 months' time. What would that look like? And you know, what would need to happen between now and then for us to be considering a $5,000 or $10,000 increase? And that's really just saying, okay, I'm accepting your decision, but we're going to talk about this again. And I think the really important thing here, and this is why I say to people, even if you get a no, that will influence the thinking and the conversation 6 or 12 months later. Because if you're told no now, in 6 or 12 months' time, when they're thinking about REM and they know that they've upset you or disappointed you 12 months prior, that's going to impact the conversations and the thinking that's going to go on then. And so it's unlikely, doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but it's unlikely that they're going to say no to you again. And importantly, you've put an expectation on the table that you feel like you're underpaid and you're expecting something different. And when we expect something different, not always, but often things are done different. And I've seen this all the time. You know, people have gone in, they've had conversations around REM. They've been uncomfortable, they've been difficult, and they haven't gotten the outcome. And then 6 months later, they come back, and this happens, you know, very regularly. They come back and say, I got the number I asked for. It just took a little bit of time. They had to work through some of the politics in the organization, or actually, because I raised it, it started a conversation with HR and with you know, potentially if it, you know, we talk about the gender pay gap, it started a conversation, and now things are happening to remedy the situation.
So it's good to have patience with it, and like you said, kind of give them a few alternative ways that they can make the job valuable for you.
Yeah, and no means not yet or not now. It's not just no, full stop. What we know from the research though is when particularly women get a no, they won't go back. You know, it's rejection. It feels uncomfortable. I don't want to risk rejection again. I don't want to feel awkward. And I don't want to risk what we often language as breaking rapport by having this conversation. So it's easier and more comfortable for me not to have the conversation. The challenge is when we don't all step up and push the boundaries on this. And I say this from women, when we don't do this, we create a culture where women don't do this. Whereas the more that we all start to step up and have a conversation around remuneration, negotiate salary, even if we're in that conversation or in that situation, not getting an amazing outcome, we are setting a new expectation that we will negotiate, that we will ask for more, that we do not what we're worth. And all of a sudden, that is what's voiced into the system and we start getting different responses.
Mm. I totally agree. And I think the more people that listen to this, these kind of interviews and feel like, okay, so I've got some actionable steps that I can take to negotiate for myself and actually stand up for my own worth. Because like you said, it's a big thing. It affects so many people. And I was even having a conversation with someone the other day in our members club, and she works for like a community arts role. And she was going through this process of, you know, wanting more money. And she was like, my company just doesn't have the money. Like I could ask for more, but I'm actually just not going to get it through there. And I sort of said to her, similar to how you've just said, is that you need to set the expectation for yourself. And if you're going to stay there for another 12 months, you need to know if there is any money on the table for you. And if not, is there a job title change? Is there other perks to the job? And she was like, yeah, because that's so tricky, isn't it? Having, you know, a job where you actually don't have any idea if you're going to get a pay rise or not. And it does affect your self-worth. And then where do you go from there?
Yeah, but you've got to ask, you know, you have to, you're entitled to know, you know. Yeah. And my view is, yes, there's certain industries and organisations that, you know, are capped on headcount. And I think this is where we come to a conversation around value exchange. My only caveat here is this is a cop-out for most women where they say, oh, but, you know, I've got great flexibility or I work with really nice people. And, yeah, culture in organisations has moved on enough that says you don't need to compromise 20 or 30% of salary to work with nice people and have workplace flexibility anymore. Like organisation cultures have moved on. And so I think it's this piece around being able to get clear around, you know, what is it that I want from my workplace? And the language we use is get clear on what's important to you, but what is it that I want from my workplace in terms of sort of people I want to work with, the sort of tasks I want to be focused on, the sort of culture I want to be surrounded with, leaders, all of those sorts of things. And understand holistically what you get beyond just money. And then be able to be clear about whether those needs are being met. And without a doubt, you know, there's times when I say to clients, you know, I would compromise a good $20,000, $30,000 to get that brand on your CV for 2 years because that is going to pay itself back, you know, multiple times over the course of the next 10 or 15 years. And so in that instance, it's the brand and it's the experience of working in that brand that means you've actually acquired an asset that is valuable for the lifetime of your career. And so it's being able to look at the currency and language I use is professional assets. What assets are you acquiring? Skill, capability, experience that is increasing your professional currency. And it's beyond the paycheck. And so I think the more that people can start to look at that holistically, the easier it is to understand what you're worth and what you're asking for. But secondly, the more that you can actually shine a light on the fact that maybe you are compromising on money for the sake of things that maybe we're in a time now where you don't need to.
Mm, I think that's really great advice. And do you have any other sort of tips around asking? Is there anything we haven't covered off in your lovely 7 steps? I mean, all the stuff you've said, like, is really valuable. I think there's a lot of actionable things people can take away from it, which is fantastic. Is there any other final words you would have for anyone in a position where they're going to ask?
Yeah, look, I think it's really, you know, it's one thing for us to do it for ourselves. What's interesting, and particularly with women, what leverages us to take bigger risks and have more courage is when we're doing it for other people. And so most of us, if we were had to go in and ask for pay rise for our best friend, we'd nail it, right? We'd be all over it. It's when we're doing it for ourselves that feels really uncomfortable and a lot of the self-talk gets in the way. And so, you know, I always say to people, you know, this isn't just about you. This is about how other women are paid. It's about what happens in our system in the next 20 or 30 years. And yes, there's lots of reasons why we have the gender pay gap, workforce participation, you know, loads of different reasons. But one of them is the fact that we are not asking. You know, when we've got 50% of women feeling like they're underpaid by 10% or more, and half of those women not having a conversation, that is influencing the gender pay gap. And that influences it today. It influences in a year, 2 years, 3 years' time. So I think this piece around the purpose with which we're having these conversations is just not about money for you. It's about setting new expectations. It's about challenging the status quo. And you're not always going to get the perfect outcome. You're not going to be celebrated for speaking up and asking. But you will make an impact in one form or another, hopefully for your own back pocket. But you will have an impact. Never underestimate. Sometimes you don't see it immediately, but you definitely will have an impact on yourself, on your organization, and ultimately on our society as well. So I think that final piece is just really own it. Talk to people about it, get feedback, get coaching if you need it externally, so that you really arm yourself going in. The sad thing for us in Australia is that organisations make it really difficult. They make it harder for us to have those conversations. So when it's an awkward conversation you don't want to have and it's made difficult, those two things together naturally make us want to really avoid this sort of situation, which means that we do need to armour up. We do need to resource ourselves to go in, have the confidence and courage and ask for exactly what we're worth.
I love it. Great pep talk to end the interview. I think that's really great. Thank you for sharing all of those amazing tips. You've got a book out, haven't you, Core Confidence, and you've got loads of things going on. So where can people sort of find out more about the book and about what you're up to at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. So best place to find me in community is www.youngprofessionalwomenaustralia, so ypwa.com.au. You can find us online or in our Facebook group as well and page. There we're talking, you know, we do monthly webinars. I guess focus very much on the sorts of issues professional women face working in organisations. And in terms of the book, that's called Core Confidence. That's been developed, I guess, from a lot of the coaching work that we've done in our leadership program over the last 5 years. So here we talk about the concept of core confidence. I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but certainly really tightly linked to the conversation around negotiating salary. And so that website is www.coreconfidence.com.au.
Amazing. So I will leave links to all of those resources in the show notes of the podcast as well. And thank you so much. Like, you've been really inspirational to talk to. And I really love to hear what everyone thinks of the podcast interview. And hopefully it will have inspired people to go into work and think, okay, it's time. It's time to ask for a pay rise.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. Excited to be your first guest back post-bub. And really look forward to, you know, connecting and hearing more about your community.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kate. If you want to connect with more amazing women like Kate, then you can jump over to our members club at shementors.com.au/members-club. The difference is that every single one of us donates 1 hour of our month to someone else. So it's peer-to-peer mentoring. We have these conversations every day. We're helping each other. We're talking, we're sharing advice, exchanging ideas. We'd love, love, love to see you. So please do jump across and do that. You can also follow us at She Mentors on Instagram as well. All right, catch you next time. Thanks.